Hello, everybody, and welcome to Lost Explorers. My name is J. David Osborne. That is Chris Sacknessum. Chris, how are you doing this rainy Las Vegas evening?
David, I'm doing pretty well. It is raining here, and I've got some exciting news that, the show keeps reaching out to oddball people. I'm sorry to characterize our listeners as oddball, but, that's just the way it is. We've talked and very recently about in the last episode, particularly about the problem with celebrities not sticking to their roles and us hearing about them more than we want to. Well, I've met well, I haven't quite met her, but she is listened to that show, and she's involved in an AI project of managing and analyzing media. And she said, if you have any doubts that celebrity figures, actors, we're hearing more about them than we really want to outside of their roles. And Daniel Day-Lewis is one of our examples from the last show, who really just sticks to his own life. We just don't know what he believes, or he's not tweeting and posting all the time. And she said, well, one of the cool things about AI is that you can analyze this and really definitively say that we hear about 4,000 times more about people who are celebrities outside their roles than we did, say, in 2000 or the 1990s. It's not our imagination. We're hearing more about these people because they're just always out there, and they think that, we need to hear what they're saying, Bob De Niro, all the time. And so I think it's interesting that we're reaching out to people who have some skills and who they have some deep skills that kind of reach beyond our tech level. And in this case, it's a female, which I think is hot and cool. And I also think it's interesting that AI, for all its anxieties, and I think we should rightfully have many, can actually validate some intuitions we have about the media and quantify them. So I think that's cool. So the vibe is pretty good, considering that, yes, it is raining. And I don't know. I mean, Vegas desert rain is beautiful. Vegas rain, not so beautiful. That's my thought there. You know what I mean,
Yeah, it's like Oklahoma snow. It's just
Yeah, there you go.
it's pretty for about one day, and then it turns into gray slush and it just
Yeah.
squishes under your feet. It's kind of nasty. I wanted to show you, or talk to you about rather. I can send it to you later. This Substack called The Honest Broker. Guy named Ted Goya. He
That
did
name
a
rings a bell.
yeah, I had read, I think I've read some of his posts before. They might have been
How do you spell that surname?
Gioia.
I'm sure I know, Ted. I'm sure I know.
I'm sure you do too. He wrote something called The State of Culture 2024 with this.
Okay. Yes, I do. Yep.
With the subtitle is "Or a Glimpse into Post-Entertainment Society, It's Not Pretty." I will summarize this by saying that he posits artists used to believe that we had two different poles that we could go to. One was art and one was entertainment. One is giving people what they want, and one is challenging them in some way. And he says that we often thought as artists of art as a little fish being swallowed by a bigger fish called entertainment. He says that there are two even bigger fishes now. The first fish, the one that's swallowing up entertainment, is distraction. So
Huh.
it's not about art, it's not about entertainment, it's about distraction. And the final fish, because of the dopamine loop incurred by distraction, is addiction. So it's appropriately dire and on the nose with what we've been saying in Lost Explorers, that we're not even talking about, you know, a battle between art and entertainment anymore. Art is so far down the line that it's a koi fish to addiction's great white shark, right?
That's, I get you. I really do. I think that's exactly, that's so on the money. And money is the key, you know, real fiber ingredient here. That's, yeah, okay. Well, I want to see that link, man. I think that's really, it's a little bit too true, you know?
Yeah, he says, the platforms are all shifting to scrolling and reeling interfaces where stimuli optimize the dopamine doom loop. Two, anything that might persuade you to leave the platform, a news story or an outside link, is brutally punished by their algorithms. It might liberate you from your dependent junkie status, and that can't be allowed. But wait, there's more. Three, Apple, Facebook, and others are now telling you to put on their virtual reality headsets, where you are swallowed up by the stimuli, like those tiny fish in my food chain charts. You're invited to live as a passive recipient of make-believe experiences, like a pod slave in the Matrix. Sad but true. Well said, Ted.
I think it's a little too true. You know, it really is. Mm-hmm. It's just too true. And I think that really the sad thing is that it resonates with people like you and me, that you know, we'd like to think that we're beyond this. And this is where a lot of our techniques of breaking free of this hypnosis, you know, this is why we're doing it. Because it is so addictive, and you get sucked in before you even know. And pretty soon, you know, well, you're wanting this little hit, you know?
Yep.
And also, I think that one of the things that I notice, you know, as a pretty high level, fast moving creative person, is that you do need that little break. You need that little treat. You know, you're not above that. And it's a question of where you go to find that. And suddenly, you know, I mean, for all the people out there who have ever had any experience with cocaine, I think this is a really good model for it. I think a lot of other drugs are, you know, of course, are in the mix, but I think that was one of the little things that broke, and I'm not talking about crack cocaine or freebasing or all the other things. I'm talking about, you know, proper cocaine, and the ritual of you know, doing some lines. There was a polite way of thinking about that that made it so desperately accessible and cool and easy.
Hey, man, you want to do a bump?
Yeah.
Who doesn't want to do a bump? Yeah, of course. Yeah,
exactly. Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that term bump, because there is that term in terms of alcohol as well, you know, like you know, an Irish coffee with a bump, you know, it's a little bit more, you know. And yeah, we all want that little bump. Or said another way, we can all justify that little bump, you know, and then, but the little wouldn't do it, and the little got more and more, you know, and that's all the game.
The major issue is just the ubiquity of the phone, it being in your pocket and so easy to turn on. I mean, that's really it. I don't want to rehash all of it because our listeners know my and your opinion on this, but it, I mean, that's what it is. Goya says in this article that, you know, it leads to a state of anhedonia, where if you're outside of that loop, you can experience fun, but you don't feel it. Mm. You can be with somebody you love, but just kind of not feel it as much as you normally would. I do think, because I remember having dial-up computer that I couldn't take with me. And then, well, even when I had, you know, DSL cable, I still couldn't take it with me. And there's just something different. Even if you're on the internet for 3 hours a night, it's not the same as the phone, the scroll, the doom scroll. That's what it is.
You know, and the swiping, you know.
Swiping, yeah.
I think the physicality of the phone Everything is very structural. We're limited to a certain size screen. We're given all these protocols that are really embedded into quite a strange, device. And if you think back to the old days, the Dick Tracy sort of, watch thing, there have been a lot of other ways that were presented as delivering what the smartphone now does. But the smartphone has been designed by certain kinds of people. And I don't know if I like all those people.
No, those same people, by the way, who don't let their children use the
I
products that they
know,
make.
I know. That's hilarious, isn't it? And it's so telling. It's so telling. Yeah, there you go. It's like, well, I'm going to make my billions off this, but I don't want you doing that. Yeah, well, okay,
So it's almost like drugs.
Or
I'm
porn.
sure they're porn. Oh, exactly. We'll make our money off of it, but you don't want your kids watching or, God forbid, participating in it. Very interesting stuff. I am curious though, if you have a band and an aphorism for us today.
I do. I don't know if I've introduced this idea before, but I really am now forging ahead with it in real life. So this is not just a make-believe band. They're called the New Zebras. They are a vocal group doing the grand Philadelphia sound, which is, I think that's beyond your reach, but it was a big part of my growing up. We're talking about Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, Tom Bell and Linda Creed, soaring Philadelphia male vocals, the stylistics, a whole world of. Well, Tom Bell and Linda Creed were the first people to really bring Black artists into the big room to record with symphonies. That's what they did that Motown was different. They really brought this lush sound into it. And the idea of the New Zebras is I just love this one student so much. He is a local Vegas DJ. He's working very hard and he's a complete nut. He would start off, I first met him in my advanced journalism class a few years back. And he would start off with things like, "We're cutting that pineapple all wrong." He was just like totally jumping into stuff out of nowhere. And he's just this magical Black dude. And he's got a beautiful, very, very strong lead falsetto tenor. And so I've engaged with them to bring back some of this big soul sound. We don't have quite enough symphonic background that Tom Bell and Linda Creed and Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff could orchestrate, so to speak, but we're working on it. And what they've done is, and the idea is to take classic 70s Philadelphia soul. Because remember, we're like the Kensington District of Philadelphia, where all the people are zombies and everyone's just completely out on fentanyl. So they're trying to sort of do some lift there. And two of the members are Philadelphians. But they have these beautiful soaring male vocals to some lyrics that I've actually contributed a little bit to. But things like, "If poop didn't smell, none." And it just goes soaring off into these beautiful, falsetto registers. And I think it's going to be really fun. And I like their fun spirit. So this is kind of a make-believe band that's becoming a little bit more real. They are anti-rap. They want to bring back male vocals, male harmony. They're working to get a gig at the House of Blues. They're, working musicians with some real background, but certainly some very strong vocal things. But all of the songs are completely subverted and wrong. and just absolutely wrong. You know,
Yeah,
everything
sounds
about it is wrong.
sounds very Saknussemmian. I do think I don't know how long it's going to take, but I do think, and this is something that people don't want to talk about because of the implication of what you're saying. I think rap's on its way out.
I hope so.
I think they're out of ideas.
Oh,
I
they
just don't think
are
there's I just
totally
don't
out
think
of ideas.
Kanye West's new album came out. It was very interesting. He's the only one who's really doing anything interesting with it, mostly because it's not really rap. It's mostly kind of industrial, almost Nine Inch Nails sounding at times. But it's very interesting music. His distributor pulled it, of course. But as a rap fan, I know there are some people who listen to this. Hi, Kelby, who would disagree with me emphatically about it, but everything comes to an end or changes. And I think they might be running out of ideas, but it also might take 20 years for it to kind of slowly die.
Yeah, look, I know, but here's the thing. I mean, I dig Kelby, and I think what you're doing with him is really cool. But, 20 years in pop culture terms is like five generations. That's a long time. Rap is so long in the tooth now, it's absurd. And the bottom line is, and I think one of my best essays is called The Secret Virus of Hip Hop. But I'm focusing on rap music and how it's destroyed recording industry cultures around the world. Jamaica, West Africa, it really just blew it all apart and was an American colonialist force, absolutely destroying local music scenes. A lot of it was because it's production cheap. It takes a lot to get an orchestra together, but this is exactly what this new band, the New Zebras, is about. And when, if poop didn't smell is kind of a ridiculous sort of subversive start on that. But it's a hint back to when black recording executives, and this is still Black History Month, they brought orchestras into the picture. They created that possibility. So yeah, that's going to be more difficult. Real people, real playing, real acoustical instruments. It's a lot more expensive than someone shouting into a mic, Get that. I get that indeed.
Yeah, and
But
I know, I also know that listeners would be like, it's so culturally dominant. How could you? Well, so was disco at one time. Everything has its moment and everything eventually fades. I don't know what's going to replace it, but I don't think we'll see it in its current form very often in 20 years. I think it'll be antiquated and people will look at the 20-year-old rappers who are mumbling into microphones now as kind of maybe an embarrassment.
well, I think that one basic thing about this is that popular music needs to adapt to all of the occasions in life that people need. Like when you have your 25th wedding anniversary, do you want to hear someone shouting, Or do you want to hear like kind of a cool melody and something maybe a little bit romantic? You actually might want to hear some melody. Music will come back. Music will return. It's not going to return the way that I would like it to return. But then again, a lot of my own music is a rejection of melody structures of the past. But I certainly appreciate the craftsmanship and the artistry and the carpentry of the music. And I think that there are people bringing that back. They're not as many, but well, one of the major reasons is that liberal people have pressed so hard against religion, that black churches aren't the community centers where a lot of people learned how to play the organ or the piano or the trumpet, but I think some of this is coming back. I was at the African Methodist Episcopal Church that I do tutoring for, the Foundation of Hope. I mean, they are right in the thick of it all. And they've got young people hungry to learn music and to have somewhere to go after school where they don't get shot. And they're, I think we're going to, I don't know, what's the next generation after Gen Z? What are we calling them?
Oh, I've heard this before. Let me Google it really fast to see what the consensus is, because it's
I'm
Gus's
talking about
generation.
people who are like in middle school right now, or early middle school. Your students, your students.
Generation after Zoomers is Alpha. They're calling
Okay.
it Generation Alpha.
Well, I have a problem with that. But anyway, I like the idea that people are needing to, I don't know, find music. You know, I mean, music is all around. I mean, you know, it's just give people a few sort of tools, a few helpful hints, a little bit of mentorship, and we are going to break free of this. You know, I don't know. I'm so done with rap. I think it. I want live musicians again. I want live venues where people are playing instruments, not just synthesizers. I'm trying to make my own instruments. I think there's a whole new world of possibility, and that's my hope for young people. I think we're going to lose them on the writing, literary, storytelling, language front. I'm sorry about that, but this is one of our big themes. But I think we might keep them on the performative, level of music. I think we might get them back.
I think we could. I think we could get them back with music. I 100% echo your sentiment that writing not looking good. It's not looking good. I have some more thoughts on that, but I do want to hear your aphorism because I want to get to your amazing text message too.
Well, okay, but I will share one really hopeful message, because my teaching right now is really complex. You know, I teach at one of the most diverse state universities in America. You know, there are only white female colleagues if I were to seek them out, and they're talking about decentering whiteness in the classroom. Well, there's no whiteness in any of my classrooms. There's just no, I don't know who they're talking to. And I have a real problem with Clark County, which is the major county that embraces Las Vegas, first language speakers. I've got one class that I think are non, they're just non-literate. You know, there really are. But I have some real breakthrough people in my other class who are English as third language speakers, one from rural China. Imagine this scenario. This is a beautiful piece. He had an appendicitis and is dealing with a very remote, distant, cold father. And here's the line. He comes out of the surgery and he says, "I felt the sudden urgency in my father's eyes, and I watched my eyes open. Everything happened. Everything happened." I mean, that's just great writing under any banner, And here's someone from northern China, and my link with him is I've been near his village hunting giant aquatic salamanders.
What
And
was his second language, did you say?
I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Oh,
So
okay.
Mandarin is the starting point, and then well, no, Mandarin is his second language. I'm not even sure what his local tribal, it is tribal language. I'm not even really sure. So that Mandarin and then now to English. But I love that line, everything happened. You know, he has this moment of connection with this really remote, distant, cold father who is there for him, you know, coming out of surgery. And I just think that's really, really beautiful. But
that's cool. I like it too.
I do have an aphorism, and I've got a really good emotional challenge, an emotional challenge, not an imaginative challenge for you coming up. Isn't that interesting? I slipped. All slips are good. I want to background this with a beautiful reference to the writer John McPhee. I hope our listeners are aware of what a wonderful nonfiction writer he is. He's covered a lot of ground, but his best ground is about geology and his whole sequence, beginning with Basin and Range, which really hits hard with me because I live in the Basin and Range area. And he sums up at the end of the book in a kind of nice writerly technique. He said, if you want the sound bite, well, here it is. The absolute summit of the mountain that we call Everest is made of marine limestone.
I've heard that before. Yep. I've
and
heard that. That's a great one.
Lovely, lovely thing. So I thought, well, I'm going to start my book, The Near Distance, with stop claiming to use your memory. Be your memory. And I think that's kind of a good place. I've got a few other ideas there, but I think that's a pretty good aphorism. But I'll say a little bit more. You must. I like imperatives. My students go with me when I do imperatives, especially when I jump on the desk at my age. That's a big standing jump. Not many people can do that. You must think of yourself as a team. Otherwise, you're alone, and worse, divided into parts. So that's my jump on the desk. I do a lot of stretching beforehand. I don't try to hurt myself and get a big groin injury. But that's a big, think about that, a standing jump.
Yeah, that's impressive. I like that aphorism a lot because, all I could really do would be to repeat it. But I love the "be your memory" bit, and I do like the idea of you have to think of yourself as a team because otherwise you're alone, but not just alone, because those separate parts of you are still there, but now they're divided.
See, this is the point for listeners. David just did the thing that's so good. This is what music is about. This is what why we want to bring music back. Took it down a note. Chord change. It's not just being alone. It's being divided then into parts, and you can hear that musically laid out. It's really, really important. If you were just alone, okay, we're all alone, But no, you got to the heart of what I was saying, and I appreciate that. You always do that so well.
Yeah, I really like that aphorism. I thought that was great. What's my emotional challenge?
Well,
or
it's really not a, I think I was maybe overslept. This is a comedic challenge.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
You can do that.
Okay. So here's the deal. It's a day off from school. And let's just say you're cheating on Rios a little bit. And you've got a really hot girlfriend who is in the media. And you're meeting together. And she's got a little thing that she has to do at whatever is like your major local bank. And so you go with her because you want to get with her. And while you're in the bank, a robbery breaks out. And she goes, whoa. And she's connected with like CNN or that like, you know, and really starts, you know, saying, look, this is happening. This is a media deal. We can really, you know, we can really make some money here. You know, this is, we're hostages. We're involved in a scene. This could be how we pay for everything. So you can get out of your cheating. You can make some money. Everything can kind of work out because now this is a focal point. Cops are swooping, except one fathead somehow manages to shoot the bank robbers and they're dead. So all of your potential hostage crisis, and this challenge is called the hostage crisis or exceed our demands. So now the threat is actually gone. It's neutralized, but your woman on the side has negotiated this fabulous media deal for your stories as these troubled, anxious, victimized people, except there ain't no villains anymore. They're gone. What do you do now? Do you try to sort of like prop them up and hold them in front of the windows for the FBI and the local police to shoot? What do you do? There's a $1 million of media coverage on the line, and she wants your help. You've got to help her save this story, but the villains actually are dead.
All right, cool. I think I could do this one. I know I can do this one. All right. Let me read the text you sent. I thought this was great. Your texts are always great. Here we go. I take the view that visual art begins at the crossroads of eyes and hands. That's already a banger right there.
Thank you.
The crossroads of the eyes and hands. A stick or a bone is good. Dust mixed with water. Blood. To start. With sculpture, the question seems to me to be, how does one escape? The whole world, including open ocean, is one vast sculpture park. Or does one want to escape? That's my interjection. Yeah. With music, hands and voice are the original party starters, splashing water. Two rocks would be handy, maybe a blade of grass or a taut vine. What's not a musical instrument? Work from there. When it comes to story, however, then I reckon some serious cultural technology is required. Language. Repeatable fire, perhaps. It's interesting to me that we have elaborate formal notions of storytelling and later endless pedagogies regarding the learned skill of reading. It's very hard to find a guide to story listening. It's harder still to find the coherence of connection, satisfactory or not, between story listening and storytelling that we have with reading and writing. Now, the reason why I'm so interested in this is that I'm very likely going to be teaching English again next year. I think this is potentially first day jump on the desk type material. Writing these words on the whiteboard, reading and writing, then putting a big red expo slash through both of them and writing story listening and storytelling. So I want to wrap with you, yarn with you a little bit about this idea, because I think I can do syllabus work on day two. I think this is day one.
Well, I appreciate you as a teacher, you know, seeing some value in this. I really believe in the memory listening exercises that I have been doing. because I can see the benefit in students. What I do with each class is I give them a quick think exercise, like my CIA things, two rounds, very fast. A musical instrument. You want quick. What? Quick. You know, and then say a vocation or job. Quick. You know, and then we have a writing prompt. We break out of that and we do the riddle of the day. And I have this absolutely, she's just so wonderful. She's an exquisite young Black woman who is actually really challenged as a writer, but she's a genius with the riddles. She is so fast, and that's a point of confidence for her. So she's seeing that she can really do that. So that helps then deal with the writing problems, which is really, you know, obviously just a lack of experience and coming out of a really abysmal high school public system. But the listening memory exercise is a great way of showing how people manage completely foreign information coming in out of nowhere and how they process it. And what they often do, which I desperately encourage, is they start using their hands. You know, the moment you're using both your hands, you're starting to get in the game. Get physical with thought. You know, get physical with thought. Get physical with your own memory algorithms. And, you know, for instance, today, hokey pokey winky wom, pal go pinky mealy come, pansy wansy wire rum. Down in the Cannibal Islands, you know, that kind of thing. Those things break through a lot of channels of thinking, and they're fun. There's sometimes, and I also, you know, do really, you know, just very basic bits of text, but showing how people connect with the auditory function. This is the big idea that I think is missing, is that we have to, and it connects back to things like popular music, rap, you know. Because everyone, you know, I said, well, how many, you know, sing me a song, you know? And well, they can. And I said, sing me a song in Spanish. And they can, you know? And they connect with that, you know, we get that brain crossroads thing happening, which is starting to get really exciting. And story listening is a lost art, and it was the basis of storytelling. You know, it really was. I mean, the great storytellers were great listeners, you know, and the great musicians are great listeners. We've forgotten about listening. It's all too visual and too stimuli, you know, it's just all, you know, social media now. But you can break through that. And I have a lot of faith in this method. I really do. It's the essence of my core textbook, which is already published by Routledge Press, but it's certainly the one of the absolute essentials of the new book, The Near Distance, that use your ears, because the ears hear what the eye can't see, you know? Simple as.
I like this idea too of the yin and yang of storytelling and story listening. How, while you were speaking, I was thinking about what it would require to be a good story listener. And I realized that a certain amount of silent participation is important. You're taking in the story, you're thinking about it. But as you think about it, you're engaging in a collaborative creative process with the storyteller, where you are filling things in, you're allowing your mind to drift off, then come back, put pieces of the puzzle together, so to speak. But the other way is true as well. If you're a storyteller, you have to be listening all the time. You can't have one without the other.
No, you
So
You absolutely can. And I mean, think of one of the greatest books of, Miguel de Cervantes, Don Quixote. So much of, I mean, that is like the ultimate postmodern novel. That kind of humbles me in terms of like, I mean, Jesus, that's written in the 16th century. So much of that happens as a story within a story. It's meta storytelling in an inn. We have no idea what that inn looks like. We only have one scene that gives us any idea that it's a two-story building. It's an entire, it's an invitation for people to come into this. I mean, the inn is actually a kind of hypothetical storytelling space where people are invited to start creating their own story. It's pre-internet. It really is. It's so, it's all about you bring something to this. I'm not just telling you this story. You bring some stuff to it. And that, well, of course, that's what an inn is, isn't it? That's what a pub, that's what all those sorts of nexus crossroads of social behavior are about. Bring your stories. No one brings anything small into a bar, you know?
This reminds me also of the number one complaint that readers on Goodreads, I'm sure if you attached an IA or IA AI algorithm to this, it would discover this to be true. The number one thing that most readers get mad about in books is a lack of clarity. And what they say is, I couldn't visualize this part. Visualize. But when I'm describing reading and writing to my students and also my workshop participants or my editing clients, I always use auditory analogies about hearing the music, hearing the rhythm of the prose, and the larger rhythm of the plot, the pacing of the plot. So it is interesting to me that I guess it's fine that they're reading at all, but there is this kind of visual, like a story watcher versus a story listener, maybe a third thing that we maybe don't like as much, where, of course, visualization is a part of reading. We're all doing it in our heads all the time. Hey, calm down in there, please. I don't want to hear that.
That's a lovely title for something. Calm
What's
down,
that?
please. I love the dad thing that you, I, you know, I'm so proud of you. You're we need a strong male figure leading classrooms and families, and I'm not going to apologize for supporting that. I think this is what this is where people go wrong. This is where people go. This is where so many of my students go wrong. They don't have someone saying that. They don't have the male voice, the timbre, the real, calm down there, please.
It's getting late. He's getting grouchy, toddler stuff. But yeah, no, I appreciate what you're saying. I think that that's important too. And it's funny because it comes so naturally. You don't even mean to do it. It just kind of, well, I guess it doesn't come naturally for everybody. But no, this story listening is interesting to me because I feel like if I can pitch the kids on, approaching a novel as an interactive process by which they are creating something as they are reading, I might get through to a few more of them. Right now, when you mentioned earlier in the show about how reading is on its way out and it's in the toilet, it really is. It really is. I believe I said on this show that I was starting to teach Jurassic Park, and their reaction to it would help me to decide whether or not I was truly bullish or bearish on reading. Bearish. I'm extremely bearish because a lot of them didn't like it, but they also weren't paying attention to it. So after 6 weeks of listening to a novel or reading it, depending on their choice, they just said, you know, this book is boring. How is Jurassic Park boring? You're not listening.
No. Well, you see, this is the thing though, but I think that's a key idea of understanding how listening versus hearing works, of really, you know, being attentive to, you know, the surface level of semantics of things, but also then breaking through to another level. And I think we got to keep sticking with people. I've got a young student, another Mexicano. He's a wrestler, you know, he's a masculine machismo man, you know, and he did a beautiful performance of a ridiculous camp song, and he turned into a finger wagging girl. And I said, Arthur, you've got a genius. And he goes, I didn't. I said, no. That there's a genius there. You've got a whole bunch of characters inside you. And he's actually strong enough and confident enough to hear that and go, oh, okay. That's, in other words, that's fun, and everyone enjoyed that. And I said, well, didn't you hear the response? So I think that we might be heading back to a new oral tradition form, but I'm hoping that it has a little bit more depth and substance than what rap music has gotten to, which I think has just fallen apart. But I think that there is a possibility that people can activate the auditory function again, the ancient way of processing language, and really start doing some fun things with it, and having some moments of play, and also being able to dig a little bit deeper, and to see that there are curtains of semantics, you know, there's music first, and music of language is very important, and it's fun, and it gets back to what we were talking about in our last episode of non-denotative vocalizations that we experience with animals, children, each other in moments of passion, perhaps. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff going, this wonderful world of vocalization of women during sex. I love this whole category.
Yeah, you mentioned it last time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it turns out that, you know, women who are more vocal during sex are, well, they report being qualitatively more happy in life. They're more fertile. They have fewer sexual related diseases and anxieties or psychological issues, but physical and psychological. They're just happier, you know? And I think it's like, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. You know, it's an old childhood thing of like, yeah, be a little bit expressive, you know, be like a dog, you know, have your ears up, ready to go. You know, there's no harm in that. You know, that's kind of, the world likes a responsive creature. The world is about response.
I'm going to take that into the classroom tomorrow, probably. And say the world enjoys people who respond to things. I'm also gonna link in some graphs from this article, and I'm really gonna have to have a heart to heart with some of these kids tomorrow and say, has it occurred to you that you might be an addict? Like you might actually be addicted to it? Think about it. When a lot of these kids have grown up with addicts, right? So it might hit a
Yes,
sore
yeah,
spot.
yes.
And just say, I mean, so if you've been around addicts, you know what happens when you take away, daddy's bottle of vodka. How does he act when that's gone? What happens when you take away mom's stash? How would she react to that? Now, how would you react if I told you all to put your phones away for the entirety of this hour? It's kind of similar. They lash out at you. Kids who I have great rapport with, it's just like all of a sudden they're, you know how in The Lord of the Rings, when in the Fellowship film, when Bilbo sees the ring again and he goes, rah! It's frightening.
That was good. Yeah, you did a good Bilbo there. Yeah.
It's like that though. And I think it might be, you know, not only are you not living up to your personal genius, but a lot of them are setting themselves up for lives of just anhedonic wandering, you know? And
Well said.
I don't want them to do that to themselves. I like them, you know?
Hey, man.
But it's so much more, I don't know how much more dire I can make it seem. And I know people who are listening to this who are thinking like, oh, just old people complaining about young people again. No, when I was young, I was a shithead and I drove my teachers absolutely insane. My English teacher hated my guts because I was wild in class. I was, you know, pretending that my binder was a dragon and saying smart ass things about the reading, but I was doing the readings.
Yeah, look, no, David, I wouldn't worry about people thinking that this is old people talking about. I mean, like, because you're a lot younger than I am. Fuck them. I think that what we're talking about is something really important about.
It's the issue. Sorry to
Yeah.
interrupt.
No, it's a breakdown in culture, and we're at a deciding moment, crossroads of whether or not at least American culture will survive into the future. And it is a very conflicted, so, you know, it's not like Norway where everyone's white and speaks one language, you know, it's not like that. It, I mean, there's nobody white in my classes. And I don't know what language we all speak. We're trying to work it out. But I think that I really encourage you not to worry about at your stage with still 36 summers to go. I don't know if anyone says that, you know, you're an old fuddy-duddy. Well, then, you know, well, where is the rest? You know, where am I? But I don't think that's what that what's that's not what's going on here. It's about a moment of crisis in an American institutional system and a dream of public education that is. Perhaps, I mean, maybe it was just ill-advised from the start. But in any case, there are frontline performers, and you're one of them, and I am too now. And I don't think it has anything to do with age at all. I think it has to do with hopes and dreams for young people finding the joy of language, the capability of critical thinking, the possibility of realizing some connection with other people. Because like, I mean, what other mechanism for sharing is there? Language.
Yeah, language.
There's no other mechanism.
Yeah, and you know, listening. Being an active listener, a lot of them don't understand that being an active listener is a fun activity. That reading, listening, go ahead.
Well, as you speak, so do you listen, as you read, so do you write. It's a cycle.
Yeah.
It's a circuit of communication, and there's no escape from it. You know, if you're not good at the one, you know, you're not going to be good at any of it. It starts to fall apart. And it is an important, it's the ultimate life skill.
It really is. It really is. So I appreciated this story listening thing. I'm definitely going to use it. Would you like to hear
I want to
my
go to the
version?
bank.
Let's go to the
Let's go to the bank with the hot chick on the side, the
Yeah.
dead villains. Yes, let's hear it all.
Okay. So the first thing that I do before the buffoon, who I'm just calling the buffoon
Yeah.
for this summary, before the buffoon shoots the bad guys, the first thing that I do is get on my phone and create an account at that bank. I have plausible deniability. You know, babe, I made all those subscriptions to different streaming services, and now I don't have the emails I use to start them, so I can't cancel. So I just decided to shut the whole thing down and start over.
Like it.
After the buffoon shoots the two bad guys, this woman convinces me to keep it going, or else she's going to reveal the affair. Right?
Oh, okay. Making it
Yeah.
personal. Making
Makes
it
it personal.
personal. Put it
Makes
down in
it.
your pants. That's a good idea. I like that.
So first thing we have to do, because he does have a gun, is to convince the buffoon that he has to play the robber now. It takes a significant chunk of our money, but he agrees to don the ski mask after wringing it out of all the blood and brain matter. Of course, what ends up happening as we set up our scenarios and they begin to escalate is that the buffoon actually method acts his way into being the hostage taker. Maybe something the negotiator says wakes up something inside of him. Once the reporter's story begins to get out of her control, she tries to rein it in. The other hostages, by the way, are completely bewildered by what is happening and will be a source of a lot of comedic levity, comic relief. Because to them, it just seems like this guy was maybe part of the bank robbers the whole time. They have no idea what's going on.
Oh,
So I'm thinking like a black woman and an Indian guy as like the two other patrons of the bank who are just like, what's going on? Then the buffoon begins executing hostages. One who reminds him of his father, one who reminds him of a guy who robbed him for $30 at the Trader Joe's.
Oops.
At a certain point, the girlfriend stands up and delivers a speech that she'll have been planning throughout this entire film, right? She's working on her big monologue. I live stream her on the phone, but unfortunately for her, she reminds the buffoon of his ex-wife. And that's how far I've gotten so far. Not sure how to wrap it up, but that's the premise.
I like this. Some look. I One of the things I love is that you always manage somehow, and listeners will. They're on to you too. It's not
They
just me,
are.
because although my auditory awareness is very high, I love how there's always some gore element that creeps in there. The ski mask, the brain matter, I think that's really that's one of the signature Osborne traits, is there's got to be some, some blood and mess
Some
that's
blood and mess. That's right. That's right.
Oh, I you know I really enjoyed that, and I think that there's I'm going to try to actually put you in some more of these challenges where there's a comedic element, because I think that's an underdeveloped side of your whole deal, and I think it's very important because you've got a good feel for it. And I mean, comedy, farce, horror, and suspense are all on a spectrum, aren't they? I mean, they're really just timing and just make, they're on the same thing, So I think that was really fun, and I don't know. This has given me some new ideas for another thing of just pushing you into these little corners that flush out more of the Osbornean point of view. We all do have point. I think this is what I think writers are so lonely for, is someone interested enough in them to sort of seek out what is unique to their point of view, and just, not just interview them, although we're about to get to that idea, but to pull out some of the things that make their aesthetic unique to them,
I think so too. Yeah, to have your what you do inside your head every day be told to you in a way that perhaps you've never thought about, or perhaps is just worded perfectly enough that you know a little bit more about yourself. That's big. Not just, so what's your process like? I don't know, man.
Oh,
I
yeah.
sit
Now,
down and
fuck
write.
that. No. I want to be more forensic and blowgun dart, right off. It's like, no, we're going to put you in the bank with this hot affair that you're having and someone's getting shot. And no, have the courage to be upfront with people you really care about, to put them in situations where they might reveal something deep about their whole program. I mean, if they can't handle it, if they can't deal with it, well, okay. But you might have then learned something yourself about them, and maybe that's a friendship that you don't, want to go to again. I don't know. Find people who are willing to rise to the challenge, because that's the essence of art. That's the essence of music, for sure. Are you going to play, are we going to play together or not? That's the thing. So I always enjoy that, David. You deliver on that, and I think this is an important part of the Lost Explorers idea. I'm sure listeners hear this. It inspires me. It gives me something to take back to my own practice, but also to my classroom and my, completely insane teaching situation. And I hope it gives you something too. So
Oh
that's
yeah,
good.
it does for sure. Absolutely. Do you have a tool and a tip for us today?
All right, we're going to get right down to it because we're teacherly here. I want to talk about, I think, a fundamental life skill, certainly a fundamental writing skill. When I was in high school, I won a scholarship to go back to the Chicago Tribune when Studs Terkel was still alive. I know it's a really old school, but I hope people know who that is. He was a really great writer. I mean, those were the days when people smoked cigars in the Chicago Tribune office. And he had a lot to say to me about interviewing skills. And I don't mean being a Gen Z person trying to hustle up the job. I mean being able to interview other people in a journalist sense. And I just want to outright read what I share in my classes, because I know in the Advanced Media Studies program at UNLV, I've been at Columbia, which is also a great, great, formerly great school of journalism, and Northwestern, which is a school that I was accepted at and declined. I think it's just really basic stuff, but I'm going to read it straight up. Strong interviewing requires fluid interpersonal capability, respect, attention, focused interest, but also a solid game plan that you don't lose track of. This becomes all the more important if there's some medium, like now the phone or Skype or Zoom, between you and the subject. Honing your interviewing techniques keeps you in close touch with your subject and the larger idea of subject. This is what a lot of young people have lost. What is a subject, really? One, open with a question that demonstrates some hot reading interest, research, credibility, ethos. You want to instantly convey that you're not just anybody and that you've done some homework. That's easy, right? Yeah, right. Yeah. Think of yourself as the host of a party. Offer invitation and welcome, both substantively and tonally. The more assertive, confrontational, an actual news style interview is or becomes, the more important this opening approach is. Think about your posture. Miles Davis said everything is about posture. We assume talent, we assume everything. Have some posture. This is what young people are really often missing. Develop an acute alertness to key words. Expanding our repertoire of listening strategies, this ties into everything we've been talking about tonight, makes us better communicators. The key word emphasis is one of the main listening strategies. The technique of mirroring is much in vogue now, often preached in business negotiation courses. This is really parroting and is terribly annoying, and in genuine interview situations is completely contraindicated. Avoid it as you would open sewage. You have innate oral tradition capabilities, deep, deep magic. You do not need to repeat the last word that someone said. Trust in deep, deep, ancient capabilities. Relax into them. They will connect dots for you and help you extrapolate and advance the interaction in dimensional, not just linear terms. Triangulate. Direct the subject out of herself to a topic. Stage magic, basic stage magic. Use the topic questions to reflect. And here's the kicker. But much more importantly, to refract. This is also how to judiciously demonstrate some personal resonance. And here's one of my great life credos. The proof of understanding a code isn't just being able to translate a message, it's being able to send one back. And this is, I think, what you do so brilliantly, David, and which I'm so grateful for. I need it as a friend. I need it as an intellectual and artistic partner. But the proof of understanding a code, understanding someone else, is not just being able to translate, oh, you said this. Mm-hmm. No, being able mm-hmm. to speak back in that code. Finally, try to pose questions that no one else has or no one else could. But don't be afraid of asking very simple questions. Every good interview, and I think this is true about every good relationship, every good love affair, every good fuck, is a collaboration and a partnership. You know? So this mm-hmm. is something I'm really, really strong on. I think this is what young people are really not hearing. It's something, and I tell myself that this is not something that I feel like I'm on top of, you know. Yeah. I'm working it out too, you know.
Yeah,
beginner's mind, partnership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important to keep that beginner's mind all the way through.
Totally.
That's what we're here to do. First of all, one of the books my grandfather bought me when I was 12 years old, he took me to a Barnes and Noble. It was very unusual for him to physically take me to a store and buy a book for me. There were some handoffs here and there, but he took me very specifically once he heard that I wanted to be a writer, and he bought Studs Terkel's Working.
Oh, I love that. It's just a gorgeous book. I hope listeners know that book. It's just a beautiful, The City of the Big Shoulders, Chicago, mm-hmm. you know, Carl Sam. Terkel brought that to life in a new way, but Working is just an absolute American classic of nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally what I was thinking of when I
mm-hmm.
mind. Absolutely mm-hmm. mandatory for people who are interested in people, let alone writers, mm-hmm. interested in people.
And don't you think that is the biggest problem with nonfiction and fiction right now, is a fundamental disinterest in other people? I do think that disinterest with a capital D, specifically in other people, but in most things too, it's the apathy that we're sensing when we sense it from these people. They're there to speak at you in a bad imperative way, not a good imperative. It's usually not even imperative. It's very often rhetorical questions because they're cowards. But what I like the most about about that in particular was the idea of also not being afraid to just ask simple questions, because that to me is that push and pull that makes all good writing good. It's that flow. You could analyze a sentence from Gene Wolfe or Ursula Le Guin, and you could see how it gets complex and musical, and then the very next sentence will have four words in it. Boop. It's the blank spaces between the, it's the notes that you don't play, even though you're speaking. And I think that that is just as important when you're in a relationship too. Sometimes it's knowing when to just, hey, how are you doing? And it's not a rote question. It's not routine. It's just, hey, how are you doing? Other times you get more in depth with it. So the interviewing idea of, you know, bringing something of yourself to it, again, acting as though it's a collaborative act, not a list of questions that you have to ask Brad Pitt at a press junket. I think that holds a very important key that can solve a lot of the big picture issues that you and I talk about on here. The kind of nadir that we see ourselves in culturally, it's just people not listening. I really like, by the way, that this tip or tool, was this, this is the tool, fits in so nicely with your main body discussion too, because that is a great extrapolation on story listening. Interviewers are story listeners in addition to storytellers down the line.
Well, I you know, it's all one meditation, isn't it?
Yeah.
And don't be afraid, you know, to ask questions that you really want, that you're curious about. Being curious is a great thing. Here's a question. This is a performance in real time. I just thought of this. This is a question I've been thinking about with you. I'm wondering, do you pick Gus up as much as you used to? He's getting bigger. He's a solid boy. I mean, how's that working? Do you actually, you know, how, you know, I'm curious, like, what's the, you know, what's going on?
If you'd asked me that a week ago, I would have said no, but we went to the Wichitas yesterday for President's Day and I carried him the whole way back. And today,
what's the Wichitas? Sorry, I don't know.
Oh, it's the only mountain range in Oklahoma.
Oh, okay, and the mountain. Okay, yeah,
it's not.
Yeah,
it's not even technically.
I get
they're
it.
Not,
okay,
they're not technically mountains. They don't quite.
I get. No, make, no. I thought it might have been a theme park or something.
Right, yeah. Right. But don't tell the mountains that they're not really mountains, because I think it might hurt their feelings.
Yeah.
But so I carried him all the way back, and then today we played like crazy monkeys, and I did a lot of throwing them around and throwing them up in the air and dancing. And so recently, yes.
Okay.
But often, no.
Okay. So this is the thing, you know, I think that we all need to relax around each other and just ask questions and engage, mm-hmm. and think that we might be that moment that something happens. I really believe that a lot of intellectual and artistic development, and just if you don't want to have that pretentious level, just emotional, psychological development doesn't happen in people's lives because people didn't ask them the right questions at the right time. Have mm-hmm. some courage to ask people some questions. And if they freak out, well, you know, you can just say, I'm sorry, that was too personal or whatever. But interviewing is a great skill, and I think that interviewing is a great art form. I love interviewed books. I love James Dickey's self-interviews. I love Gary Snyder's book, The Real Work, which is a series mm-hmm. of interviews from him around the Pulitzer Prize time for Turtle Island. I love interviews. I think interviewing is the essence of art. Truman Capote said that. So
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
all good. All good.
That's cool. I had a coworker who was asking me about, you know, writing novels, and she has a outline that she worked on a long time ago. And I said, well, you should write that. And she said, well, you know, you've heard it before. Well, I don't know. And And then I asked, what are you afraid of?
There's the go. There's the
And
go.
she's writing it now. So, I mean.
Good. Good. You know, it's like, damn.
Yeah.
What are people so fucking afraid of, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I have my star sign is a Sagittarius, and Rios calls me a Sagittarius because I often tend to bluntly say these kind of things. It's what gets me in trouble too. You've seen how much trouble I get into. But I think that I treat every conversation as a kind of, you know what, it's really easy if you're interested. When I interrupt you and ask you a question, it's just because I'm interested. You know, I mean, and they sometimes come out of left field. I mean, you're always game, so you answer. But I just say whatever. I follow my curiosity wherever. If I want to know something, I ask it.
Man, that's the thing. The meander map of your own, you know, strange discovery plan. And I think it's wonderful. You know, Ellen, my mom is a Sagittarius, but if you haven't heard the wonderful Jim Morrison thing, you know, he goes, I am a Sagittarius, the most philosophical of all the Sag. And then he goes, I don't believe in that bullshit, but I'll tell you this, I want to have my fun before the whole shit house goes up in flames. All right. You know, he's in Miami or somewhere. But I think that's wonderful. Man, I think that's wonderful.
That's hilarious. And what is your tip for us today?
Okay, this comes from the near distance. I'm really concerned about, if we're talking about memory, I think we've got to talk about forgetting. I think that's a fundamental problem. There is a word for forgetting, obsolescence. We really don't understand it very clearly, but this is a simple little exercise, and I know it sounds stupid, but my mailbox is about, say, 30 to 40 yards across the street. And I thought, what if I consciously decided to forget my mailbox key? Okay, so that looks stupid, right? That looks like I'm going to the mailbox and I know I'm not going to be able to open it. And I know I'm going to have to come back to get my key. But wow, the adventure I had doing that, it was a mind blow. I suddenly saw things very differently. I mean, it really opened up some channels of thought that this is what one of my signatures that I want to own is doing really stupid things that appear to be a complete waste of time that completely then fragment or absolutely shatter your ideas of what you think you're doing. You know, we all think we're doing this, you know, and it was a real, real revelation. So I went out to the mailbox, consciously forgetting my keys. And then I returned to go get my keys. Simple. Anyone can do it. But if you do that with a good heart, you know, I can't say, you know, you got to have the heart. You got to have the Sartrean good faith. But I saw something open up that I wouldn't have seen otherwise. Because I would have just been automatically going, you know, and I broke that pattern. And my whole gig changed for about 2 hours. Yeah. So that this is about breaking up routines and structures of preordained, predetermined thinking that really lock us into a program of avoidance and ignorance and non-alertness of other things. If you want to get your alertness back, then you have to sort of do some weird Solomon Islander shit and maybe consciously forget your keys or, you know, put something somewhere else or, you know, that kind of routine breaking. And I'm of course documenting this in a little bit more strategic and structured format for the book, but I think the idea is clear.
Oh, I like that. I like that. I was enjoying that. I was also lost in thought about ways that I was gonna disrupt my pattern. So I was having this elaborate fantasy of going into my class tomorrow and standing in the corner, facing the corner, like I'm in trouble, and just standing there for about 2 or 3 minutes, unmoving. Just seeing what the reactions might be from the kids. Or I did this the other day. I went into the class and I, for the first 5 minutes each class, I spoke to them exclusively in Spanish and
There you
acted like
go.
I didn't know what was wrong when they asked me, like, why are you speaking Spanish? I was like, ¿por qué no? Es mi idioma. But like, and I kept the bit up. So yeah, you had me in a little bit. You caught me in a reverie there. But yeah, that's.
Okay. This is, and I'll just lay one other thing on because I'm trying this out on someone important to me, but I really believe in this technique. We can't really control the drive that we have to take to get to work. We need to get to that place, right? We can control a little bit more the drive home. So what I've got three people to sampling this idea now. I just say, look, don't break your, don't go too far away, but go like three streets away to an address where you don't live. As if you live there. Just park on this. You don't have to go up and knock on the door and you don't do anything weird, but just go as if you're going to that place rather than to where you actually live. Look around a little bit. See what happens to you. See what happens to your mind. Breaking patterns is, you got to do it simply. It's the old CIA thing. You don't change huge cultures by going, oh, you can't do that. You do little things, little things. You go to a different address. Who lives there? Oh my God. Wait a minute. Actually, you might have some contact with them. They might have more to do with you than you think. So breaking those habits down is good. And on that note, to close up, I'm going to report an important breakthrough on the dreaming front. We've kind of mentioned this at several different points in the show, but I think we touched on this earlier, that I think the pursuit of lucid dreaming, or rather managed dreaming, directed dreaming, is potentially possible. For whatever reason, well, there is a reason. On my Facebook feed, my cousin, who is almost exactly my age, she's 12 hours different. I don't have much to do with her at all. She's a lovely person. I have met her family in a few years back, but we just totally different people, totally different on every level. But I just decided, well, look, there is a family connection there. I'm going to actually have that picture in my mind, and I decided that I was going to take a very, very, very hot bath before bed. And I did, and then I looked at that photograph again, and for whatever reason, that triggered a memory in my childhood of having, because I'm a big target person, blowguns, and I've been an archer and, oh well, handgun shooter too, but I don't, more blowgun. But in my childhood, I had these darts that I would shoot at these targets, and one was like a gorilla. And I had a suction dart on it, and I combined that thought with my cousin, her picture coming out of this scalding hot bath. And then I took that to a very cold room, to go to. I liked sleeping cold, and there was no one with me then, so that was manageable. Local girl was just wasn't there, and I had a dream about my cousin, and it was very realistic. There was nothing surreal at all about it. She lives in North Carolina, and we were talking about Charlotte being one of the hot spots for people to move to. And I had a pretty good straight night's sleep, and I think I woke up and started recording that about 4:30 or 5 in the morning, which is when I kind of, wake up anyway. And I thought that was a really interesting example of being able to steer a little bit of that dreaming energy. And I think it's possible, and I really encourage creative people to really strive for that. I think there's an enormous dimensional universe that we can draw on that we're often just kind of swimming around in and splashing, and that's cool. That's all good. That's good. That's like sex and love and childhood, all sorts of messy stuff. But if we want to be a little bit more captains of dark mornings, to kind of maybe get a hold on that. And I think it was the meditative discipline. I think the very, very hot bath and the very, very cold room made a big difference.
That's
So
interesting. Yeah.
we're embodied in the dream, we're not stepping entirely out of our body in the dreams. That's important, I think.
It's fractal. It's fractal energy.
Yes, that's good. That's good. Yes.
No,
That's a
yeah,
nice
it's
thing. That's a nice. I
yeah.
like that. I love that word. That's a great word. That's,
Yeah, I mean it's definitely you can it's so funny because I was looking at Mandelbrot sets the other day and it looks like lava lamp balls coming together. I thought that was a funny connection from what we talked about a few episodes back. But also, I really like this idea of priming the body for its fractal hyperspace jump into dream space, right? Like you're setting yourself into
Beautifully
a
said.
tube and you're really kind of crafting like a leash for a fractal tiger that you're gonna ride. That's to me, that seems to me to be when, because I do have a friend who's very good at lucid dreaming and is able to astral project as well. And they talk about it like they've just they're a natural. He was teaching his brother how to do it last time I talked about this thing with him, and it does not come natural to his brother at all. So he's had to sort of walk him through the steps that he does, but he sort of just fell into it. But I do think that once you start lucid dreaming, you're one step away from astral projecting. And I do think as long as you have a handle on what you're doing, I think that's great. I think that's awesome. How many of these, not to keep bringing it back to these freaking kids, man, but how many of these kids do you think are ever going to be able to astral project? Their astral body's been fractaling out into cyberspace, into the matrix.
In a
William Gibson.
passive sense, they've kind of been sodomized by this whole other, thing rather than taking an active adventuring sort of role. And I think that, and what we're talking about isn't something you have to strive for every night, particularly not if you're sleeping with a partner, but it's something you could just add to the mix. It's kind of like it's tantric dreaming, That's the way I.
And I think you'd be doing dreams a disservice by attempting to control them every time. It's the same as with conversation. Every once in a while, you want to just dealer's choice, man. Show me what you got. But that's very cool though. So yeah, that'll wrap us up for tonight. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everyone. Be well. It's raining in Vegas still, so be safe wherever you are.